Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It is December 3rd, and we're going to cover urinary system. We started last time urinary system, so we'll try to finish that up today. And then next week, Tuesday, there's a lecture on diversification system. Probably just talk about the endocrine control of the reproductive system, so make sure you know your anatomy of it. Nobody's laughing. That's good. And then 1 week from today is your fourth exam, chapters 14, 16, 17, and 20. That's the deal. So make sure you bring a picture ID, because I can't release the grade unless I have a picture ID from you, and I won't see you until next year, so make sure you bring your picture ID, Scantron, nice clean one, and a good eraser pencil that's going to work, and that's great. We'll get that done. I'll get the grades in Blackboard quick. Probably within 24 hours or so. Anybody have a question on the schedule? All right, I think we're all doing pretty good. All right, we were drawing something out last time, and I think it was a nephron, right, before we had to take off. So let's finish that off. I'm not going to make a list of all the tubes that make up a nephron, but think of all the tubes right now. Think of all the tubes that make up a nephron, and they can be grouped. How many groups do you need to take all those tubes and put them in the correct group? How many groups? There are two groups. Yeah, give me the name of one group. Tubular element. And what's another group? Vascular element. Right. So what kind of material is in a tubular element? Filtrate. And if it stays in that tube, if that filtrate stays in that tube, where is it going to go? It's going to be excreted. That's right. It's going to be lost from your body. The stuff in the filtrate is lost from your body. And anything that's in the vascular system, of course, stays in your body, never leaves. All right, so here was that nephron. I think we got to go over the three processes. Is that what I remember? All right, so here is, and I'm going to abbreviate Bowman's capsule. All right, yell it out. What's that? And this, you guys are not awake. Proximal convoluted tubule, descending loop of Henle, ascending loop of Henle. And then another convoluted tubule, distal convoluted tubule, and then collecting duct. Typically, we consider the fluid in the collecting duct urine, but it still can be processed a little bit. All right. And so what's the fluid in the ascending loop of Henle? Yeah, filtrate, absolutely. All right, then we need the vascular supply. Here is a very small artery bringing blood to a capillary, and that's always what kind of vessel? An arteriole, because it's bringing blood to a capillary. And since this is bringing blood into Bowman's capsule, we call it the afferent arteriole. And then here's that fancy little capillary, kind of looks like a meatball right there. That's called glomerulus. Anybody remember what kind of capillary that is? Remember, there's three kinds of capillaries. Continuous, fenestrated, and sinusoidal. Okay, and this is the middle kind of leakiness. This is a fenestrated capillary. I'll have some pictures that I can show you in just a little bit. So here is another arteriole coming off of the glomerulus. So if it's leaving Bowman's capsule, that is going to be the efferent arteriole. And what does an arteriole always bring blood to? A capillary. So here is another capillary bed. All right, and sometimes we call these peritubular capillaries, PC, and sometimes if it is a juxtamedullary nephron, we call it VR. And what does VR stand for? Vasa recta. So the vasa recta is very important for concentrating urine when you are dehydrated. Oh, okay, the processes. Let's talk about material moving from the blood into Bowman's capsule. All right, number one. Did we do this last time? No. Okay, so number one is what we call filtration. And how does material move? Via filtration. Okay, does it go from blood to filtrate, or filtrate to blood, or for filtration? Stuff moves from the blood into the filtrate. I'm glad I'm asking this. Okay, so filtration, stuff starts in the blood, And it goes into filtrate. Like so. All right. So the types of materials that get filtered would be water, any kind of small molecule, and glucose and sodium. What can you tell me about glucose? Is that a good molecule to have in your body? Absolutely, important energy molecule. What about water? Should that be in your body? Yeah. What about sodium? Sure, proper concentrations, right? And harmful compounds like urea get filtered, which is okay because if urea then stays in the filtrate, where does it end up? Urine, and then you excrete it. That's the big deal. All right, if we excreted all the water that was filtered, we would dehydrate in about 5 minutes. I'll give you a figure of merit in the slides, right? So a lot of the water, most of the water has to be resorbed, right, in the nephron. And that process of going from filtrate back into the blood, I'm going to call that number two. Okay, and you got to be really familiar with this, right? This is tubular resorption. And even more importantly, you should know how material moves. How does it move? Tubular reabsorption. Where does the material start? Where does it end up? Starts in, so it's going to, look at the dot right there. It's either going to start in a vascular element or a tubular element. Yeah, and what's the fluid in a tubular element? Filtrate. So it's going to go from filtrate to blood. It's going to go from filtrate, which is what you're going to lose from your body, back into your body, which is the blood. All right, so I'm going to put that in parentheses right here. So for tubular resorption, it starts in the filtrate, right, and goes back into the blood. Give me an example of a molecule that would be resorbed. What good molecule ended up in the filtrate, but you don't want lost in the urine? Water, a lot of water. That's great. Water is the primary concern, right? But also sodium, potassium, glucose. These are things that need to be resorbed for electrolyte balance. All right, then the third one. Let's look at the third one. Toxic compounds, for instance, like urea, some of it gets filtered, which is a really good thing. It ends up in the filtrate, but some escapes filtration because there's no active process that's grabbing these toxic compounds and putting it into the filtrate in the glomerulus. So if there's a toxic compound that's left in the blood, right, there are active transport mechanisms that can take those harmful compounds and put them in the filtrate. And if they're put in the filtrate, where do they go? Outside your body. All right, so that is the third step. So things that are harmful that are in the blood end up in the filtrate. That's number three. And number three is tubular secretion. And how does the compound go for tubular secretion? Filtrate the blood or blood to filtrate? Blood to filtrate so that you get it out of your body. Blood to filtrate. Okay, so that's what you should remember. Maybe for the next 20 years or so we'll do, probably. Okay? Important stuff to know. All right, does anybody have a question on that? I'll leave that on the board for you to look at, and you should be able to draw that out on a blank piece of paper probably within about 60 seconds or so. Maybe, I would like to have that on the test, but I don't have time. Not even 60 seconds. All right, so I'm going to turn some of the lights down, and I am going to immediately go to slide number, 14. It is right here. Get my arrow options going, pointer options, visible, nice. Okay, so this is a really good illustration in your textbook that shows a nephron, and what do you want to, how would you describe the nephron? What is it? It's the structural and functional unit of urine formation. Yeah, structural and functional unit of urine formation. Right, so make sure you know the anatomy of all these different pieces. And remember, there's two different kinds of peritubular capillaries. Peritubular capillaries for cortical nephrons are different than the peritubular capillaries for juxtamedullary nephrons, and those we call the vasorecta. Okay. All right, so we're going to skip over all this stuff because you know pretty much what it is. And the proximal convoluted tubule, the walls consist of just a single layer of cuboidal cells, but they're special. They have microvilli on them. And what does microvilli? It's a different kind of structure. So if that kind of cell has microvilli, its function is different. What's the function of microvilli? Increases the doorway for exchange. Right? Even though your slide says surface area, that you should always think of as doorway for absorption. During resorption, salt water and other molecules that are needed by the body, glucose for instance, are transported from the lumen of the tubular cells. What's the fluid in the lumen of the tubular cells? Filtrate, and back into the peritubular capillaries. Right? So the resorption of these important compounds, and you could actually draw in glucose there if you wanted to as well. All right, if you don't have a picture in your mind of the two different kinds of nephrons, here they are. The line that separates cortex from medulla are these arcuate arteries and veins. So superficial to them is the cortex, deep to them is the medulla. And the cortical nephrons are located mostly in the cortex. The loop of Henle does descend into the medulla, but not very deeply. The juxtamedullary nephrons, on the other hand, the Bowman's capsule is close to the medulla, but the loop of Henle, right, just goes extensively into the medulla before it comes back up. Okay, so those are the two. So we'll talk about process number one, glomerular filtration, these glomerular capillaries and Bowman's capsule form a filter for blood. And these capillaries are fenestrated so that they're pretty leaky. They have large pores between the endothelial cells. And even within an endothelial cell, they can have a pore. And these pores are big enough for most plasma molecules to leak out, except large ones, like maybe some large proteins. And these fenestrated capillaries are hundreds of times more permeable compared to a regular continuous capillary. So here is a pretty nice picture. Let's go over the picture. Here is the afferent arteriole bringing blood into this capillary that we call the glomerulus, and it goes through this capillary, leaves via the efferent arteriole. Plasma is pushed out of the glomerulus into this space right here, right? And then it makes its way down through the rest of the tubes of the nephron. So what's the first tube that connects the Bowman's capsule? Proximal convoluted tubule, right? And it's so aptly named. So one way that we should think about this whole thing with glomerulus inside Bowman's capsule, we call a renal corpuscle. Right? And we should think of the renal corpuscle in the following way. Kind of model it after your understanding of a serous membrane. So let's refresh what a serous membrane is. Can anybody tell me, is it a simple membrane? Is it just one layer? Or is it a little bit more complex, a serous membrane? That kind of ringing a bell. Okay, remember there are generally two major kinds of membranes. One that line a cavity to the outside world, that is a mucous membrane. And then there are membranes that line cavities not open to the outside world, and those are called serous membranes. And a serous membrane has three parts to it. It has a part that's right on the organ, and it's called the visceral division of that serous membrane. And then it folds back onto the wall of that particular cavity that it's in, and that's called the parietal division of the serous membrane, and then there is serous fluid in the serous space between those two divisions. So probably you should think of the renal corpuscle just in that way. So here the wall of Bowman's capsule is the parietal layer of Bowman's capsule. It's continuous when it reaches over here and touches the efferent and afferent arteriole, then it folds back and covers all of the capillaries, right? The same cells that are connected together. So these cells that are touching the capillaries, this is the visceral division of Bowman's capsule. And sometimes Bowman's capsule is called glomerular capsule. I'm really not too concerned what you call it in this class, okay? All right, so parietal and visceral divisions, plasma leaks out into this serous space and then makes its way down into the proximal convoluted tubule. So let's zoom into this region. And you know this is a capillary because I just see that it's a simple squamous endothelium. I don't see layers of cells. And when I look, I also see pores within these cells. These pores are what we call fenestrations. And the molecules can leak out into Bowman's capsule. And the visceral division is made up of podocytes. And people thought, well, you know, these kind of remind me of feet. And so we're going to call this thing a podocyte. And then there's some even extensions on these processes so that there are large holes, right, between the processes of a podocyte. And we call these things filtration slits. So if we zoom into this area right here, right, we can see the whole filtration membrane. The filtration membrane is the endothelium made up of, what, a fenestrated capillary, some basement membrane, and then the podocyte foot processes with their slit diaphragms right here. That's the filtration membrane. So stuff has to move through these three layers in order to get into Bowman's capsule. And you notice that it's a very short distance. Okay. Some plasma proteins do leave the plasma, end up in Bowman's capsule, especially albumins in particular. And those albumins usually are completely resorbed by endocytosis, receptor-mediated endocytosis. So there really shouldn't be any protein in urine. Right? If there is, right, we call that proteinuria, and that means that there is something abnormal with that particular nephron that's leaking proteins. And so some of those slit diagrams or diaphragms are too large, fenestrations are too large, right? So there's some nasty structural change happening within Bowman's capsule. Another thing that excludes many proteins from entering Bowman's capsule is that the lining of the fenestrations contain a lot of negative charges. And proteins inside the cell have an overall negative charge as well. Right, so if the fenestrations are negative and the proteins are negative, will they attract each other or repel each other? They will repel each other. Right, so just by those electrical properties, many proteins can't leave the blood and go into filtrate. Nice electron micrograph that shows the podocytes, right, and the slit diaphragms all over the place, making this a really leaky structure. So here we have the endothelium. Oh, it's not labeled on this slide. Here's the endothelium of that capillary cell. Here's one of the pores that we call fenestrations. Nice basement membrane. And then the slit diaphragms of the podocytes. Right, so material has gone into Bowman's capsule at that particular time. All right, so here is another diagram of filtration. And sometimes books call this ultrafiltrate instead of filtrate. Ultrafiltrate and filtrate are exactly the same thing. And so I don't say ultrafiltration, I just say filtration. So here are a bunch of molecules like proteins, right, and other kinds of solutes, maybe sodium, potassium, glucose, right, and water isn't given a particle size. So when blood enters the glomerulus, right, a lot of this material leaves, and except for the large molecules, for instance, like proteins. Most of them have a tendency to stay in the blood. But small particles end up in Bowman's capsule. All right. So name the process by which small plasma solutes enter the glomerular filtrate or glomerular ultrafiltrate. What is this process where this thing here ends up in Bowman's capsule? That's number one. What's number one? You just don't want to tell me. It is filtration. That's right. So molecules are being filtered based on, and filtration always works based on size. Small molecules get filtered. Okay, if glomerular filtration rate is just the amount of blood that is filtered, or the amount of filtrate that's produced by both kidneys per minute, because it's a rate, it averages about 115 mLs per minute in women, a little bit more in men, And if we multiply that by all the minutes in a day, that equals about 180 liters per day, or 45 gallons of fluid get filtered by all the glomeruli that are in a kidney. Well, you can imagine that we cannot lose 45 gallons of fluid from our body. We would dehydrate well before, all right, we would reach that. As a matter of fact, we don't even have 45 gallons of fluid in our body. So that means that most of the water that ends up in Bowman's capsule by filtration must be put back into the blood. We call that resorption, right? Or death would happen very quickly via dehydration. All right, so what do we call that process when water is resorbed, when it goes from filtrate back into the blood? Tubular resorption, right? And I'll mention this again, but in the proximal convoluted tubule, there are mechanisms for resorption of solutes and glucose and water. Those mechanisms are working at their capacity. They're working at 100% all the time. Right? And you're saying, well, gee whiz, my water intake changes. My salt intake changes. But if my proximal convoluted tubule is always, it's an all or none kind of response, how does it adjust, how does the nephron adjust to my varying diet, for instance? And that's because the distal parts of the nephron then can make adjustments within the filtrate. So the filtrate in the proximal convoluted tubule, that's always 100% processed, and then there's variable processing in the remainder of the nephron. All right. So regulation of glomerular filtration rate. Most of the time, that filtration is produced by the pressure that's inside the glomerulus. So if we increase the pressure inside the glomerulus, then the filtration rate is going to increase. If the pressure decreases, then the filtration rate is going to decrease. It's just directly related. And it's got to be tightly controlled and regulated. It is regulated by two mechanisms. One is extrinsic, the other is intrinsic. And there are a couple intrinsic mechanisms, and autoregulation belongs to this intrinsic type of regulation. And what's regulated is the, basically it looks like the precapillary sphincter, right? On the afferent arteriole, when it vasoconstricts, that reduces flow. When there's dilation of these afferent arterioles, that increases blood into the glomerulus and increases glomerular filtration rate. So, and the extrinsic effect would be the sympathetic nervous system. So there are sympathetic nerves that do enter the kidney. Remember the area that a sympathetic nerve enters a kidney at? Or where the ureter leaves? Or where the artery enters? Or the renal vein leaves? What's that area on the kidney? That's called the hilus. Does that ring a bell? Hilus or hilum? Okay. All right, so here is an example flow diagram of the sympathetic nervous system, and we're going to look at what happens when blood pressure decreases or during exercise. All right, if blood pressure decreases, you can sense that with baroreceptors. Can you remember where baroreceptors are located? Okay. Probably the most sensitive are in the carotid sinus, right, which is here in your neck, and there are some also in the arch of the aorta, but primarily in the carotid sinus. So during exercise, and when the baroreceptor reflex is activated, then the vasomotor center notices that there is a change from normal, and it makes a decision on what to do, so there's the integration center. It increases sympathetic nerve activity. And what is the effect of sympathetic nerve activity on heart function? It increases stroke volume because it increases inotropy of the heart, and it increases heart rate because it is a positive chronotropic effect on the heart. So if you increase both heart rate and stroke volume, what increases? Cardiac output goes up. All right, so don't forget, the initial stimulus was decreased blood pressure. Here we see sympathetic activation that increases cardiac output because both stroke volume and heart rate increase. Sympathetic nerves also go to blood vessels, for instance, in the skin, and that increases, right, causes vasoconstriction of these blood vessels, and the radius of a blood vessel has a very strong influence on the resistance, and if you increase resistance of a blood vessel, right, then, or if you decrease the diameter or radius, that increases resistance. So vasoconstriction increases peripheral resistance, total peripheral resistance. Sympathetic nerve goes to the afferent arterioles in the kidney. That also increases total peripheral resistance. How is TPR related to pressure? You might want to be able to derive that equation. Okay, blood pressure is equal to heart rate times stroke volume times total peripheral resistance, right? So blood pressure is just directly related to TPR, so if that increases, so does blood pressure. If there's vasoconstriction of afferent arterioles, there's less blood entering the glomerulus, there's less pressure pushing fluid out in the glomerulus, that decreases glomerular filtration rate. So there's less filtrate that's being produced. If there's less filtrate being produced, what happens to urine volume? It goes down, right? So urine production is decreased. And all of these things right here increase blood volume, right? And because of the Frank-Starling law, that's going to have an effect to increase the inotropy of the heart and increase blood pressure. And what was the initial stimulus? Decrease in blood pressure, all right? So sympathetic nervous system activation increases blood pressure in response to a decrease in blood pressure. All right, intrinsic regulation. We define it to be the abilities to maintain a constant glomerular filtration rate, even when systemic blood pressure is changing. So that's pretty important. We want to keep glomerular filtration constant, even though our blood pressure might increase or decrease. And there are two mechanisms responsible for that. First one is myogenic constriction of the afferent arteriole. And these, right, when they start to stretch because there's an increase in pressure, they will be activated to contract and increasing the resistance of the afferent arteriole that will then reduce the amount of blood flowing through the glomerulus. So when there's an increase in blood pressure, there should be an increase in blood flow through the glomerulus, but myogenic constriction prevents that from happening. So if the blood pressure increases, there is not an increase in glomerular filtration rate because the afferent arteriole vasoconstricts. The second kind of autoregulation is what we call tubuloglomerular feedback. And tubuloglomerular feedback is mediated by some compounds that are produced by another part of the nephron, the juxtaglomerular apparatus. And we'll take a look at that. So here is a table that shows what the effect of various kinds of stimuli are on glomerular filtration rate. Sympathetic nerves, okay, increase resistance, right? It constricts the afferent arteriole. So sympathetic activation, if these arterioles are constricted, there's less blood entering the glomerulus, so GFR decreases as a result. Right, in terms of autoregulation, right, maybe due to decrease in blood pressure, and, or even an increase in blood pressure, either way, right, autoregulation is able to maintain glomerular filtration at the same rate, because if there's an increase in blood pressure, that dilates the afferent arteriole, allowing more blood to enter, right? Because blood pressure decreased, then the resistance has to decrease to keep blood flow the same. So there's no change, and that's what we want, no change. If there is an increase in blood pressure, right, then the afferent arteriole constricts. And again, that produces no change, but we want to maintain glomerular filtration rate at a constant level. All right, so do you have that equation in your mind right here? If there is an increase in blood pressure, how do we know that constriction should take place right there? What? Because we're glomerular filtration rate is a flow of blood, right? And what is blood flow equal to? Blood flow, everybody knows. Blood flow, the force that moves it is pressure. The force that impedes it is resistance, right? So blood flow is just pressure divided by resistance. So if we want blood flow in the glomerulus to stay the same and pressure increases, what has to also change? Resistance. And what should it do? Get bigger or smaller? Yeah, it should get, resistance should get bigger. right? If pressure gets bigger, resistance has to get bigger to keep blood flow the same. Okay? Okay. So, and what is, how do you increase the resistance of a blood vessel? Vasoconstriction or vasodilation? Vasoconstriction. That's right. So blood pressure increases, there's vasoconstriction, which then also increases resistance. That keeps blood flow through the glomerulus constant. And that's really handy to be able to do that just via vasoconstriction and vasodilation. Okay, tubular glomerular feedback. An increase in flow of filtrate by the macula densa can signal afferent arterioles to constrict. So let's see if I have a picture of that. I do have a picture someplace. Sorry, where's that glomerular? I have to show you a picture when it must be ahead. Okay, maybe in anatomy, okay, you have learned the following, right? So here is Bowman's capsule. Here is a proximal convoluted tubule, right? Or I don't see the convolutions, but if we extend this tube, it will become convoluted. And then you have the loop of Henle. Remember that? And then what comes after the loop of Henle? The distal convoluted tubule, and it just so happens that the distal convoluted tubule comes back all the way over to where the afferent and efferent arteriole enter the glomerulus, and it passes right between these two blood vessels every single time. And that's going to be called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. And the macula densa is in that tube. All right, so we don't see it on any of the diagrams yet, but it's pretty important. All right, so a lot of water and salt is filtered, so much so that we wouldn't be able to stay alive for very long, so it has to be resorbed. So here is that simple columnar epithelium, and I see a bunch of microvilli, which increases the doorway for absorption. And maybe you have even looked at this diagram on the first test. This might have been a exam figure for the first test even. All right, so how does water and sodium get from filtrate, right? Here's the lumen of a kidney tubule. What's the fluid in the lumen of a kidney tubule? Filtrate. And if all this material stays in the filtrate, where is it going to end up? Outside your body, right? So there are many good things that you don't want to lose, like glucose, and sodium, and water. So what happens? Well, here is a co-transporter, and it can take sodium, right, and glucose, and move them inside the cell. So these two compounds are coupled together, and co-transport is a form of primary active transport. So what's not on this slide right here? ATP is being used up. All right, so these things will be able to go from a low concentration to high concentration. So for instance, if glucose is at a very low concentration, it still can be pumped into the cell, right? Even though it's going from low to high because there's ATP being used. All right, so now we have high concentration of glucose inside the cell, high sodium inside the cell, and glucose then will be able to go down its concentration gradient, high in the cell, low in the blood. But remember, it can't get through the plasma membrane. There has to be a transporter, which is works by diffusion, right? That's just facilitated diffusion. So glucose enters the interstitial space. It's picked up by a capillary, and it now is back inside your body. Okay, this sodium that has entered the cell, right, would make the co-transporters work really, really difficult. Right, but there is a way to get rid of the sodium, and as a matter of fact, you want to resorb sodium, and we use the simple old sodium-potassium ATP pump that's primary active transport, and it's going to pump sodium to the outside of the cell where it should be at high concentration, and then sodium will re-enter via this capillary, right, peritubular capillary. All right, so what is being resorbed in this particular figure right here? What's being resorbed? Glucose and sodium, right, by active transport processes, right, by all these different transporters right here. And when solutes move across the tube like this and back into the body, then that increased concentration will draw water along with it. So the resorption of sodium and glucose and other things like potassium requires active transport, but water moves out of the tube, out of the proximal convoluted tubule back into the blood by that passive process. Right? It just follows by diffusion as a result. Okay. All right, so here we have a lot of water leaving, and we see that water moves out by osmosis following the concentration gradient of sodium, right? And chlorine transport is passive as well. It just has a tendency to move with sodium, so that electrical neutrality is preserved. So this process of stuff that's in the filtrate re-entering your body, that's what we call resorption. So we see the first two processes on this slide, filtration and resorption. So much water is resorbed right here that you're left with only about one-third of the original volume. So almost 70% of the water that is filtered gets resorbed back into the cardiovascular system. And that's a really good thing, right? And that's just a passive process by osmosis. Most of the sodium water is resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule, given back to the blood. And the remainder, maybe another 20%, is resorbed in the descending loop of Henle. And so by the time you get to the bottom of the loop of Henle, almost 85% of that filtered water is resorbed. And we call that just the early part of the kidney tubule. And like I said, that's constant and independent of water balance inside your body. And the thing that's driving that is what? Is that co-transporter that requires ATP, the sodium-potassium pump on the basolateral membrane of that kidney tubule, and those primary active transporters, if we add up all the calories, cost us 6% of all of the energy that's consumed in our body. Just the kidneys, just our small kidneys right there. All right, the remaining 15% of that fluid, that filtrate fluid, is resorbed depending on the level of hydration inside the body. It can be resorbed more, could be resorbed less, just depending if you're well hydrated, over hydrated, or dehydrated. So this is the adjustment. The 15% can be adjusted to meet the demands of the body. Okay, collecting duct can process urine, plays an important role in water conservation. The collecting duct is impermeable to salt in the medulla. Permeability of water in the collecting duct depends on the levels of antidiuretic hormone. All right, so what should happen to urine production when ADH is high? Urine production decreases, right? Because it's an antidiuretic. All right, so let me see. Oh, here's a pretty good flow diagram, and then we're going to look at a diagram that's in your study guide. All right, so if you have low water intake producing dehydration, then plasma osmolality, or the saltiness of plasma, increases, and there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. Hypothalamus then can signal the posterior pituitary. Right? How does the hypothalamus signal the posterior pituitary? Is it a blood vessel? Is it a portal blood vessel? Or is it a tract? It's the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract. It's a tract, right? The posterior pituitary really is nervous tissue. And then ADH, you should really consider that a neurohormone because it's being released by axon terminals, right? So osmoreceptors notice this increase in salt or osmolality of blood, tells the posterior pituitary to increase antidiuretic hormone. And antidiuretic hormone goes to the kidneys and it causes an increase of water resorption. And in particular, we're talking about the collecting duct, not the proximal convoluted tubule. So if you have more water resorption, less water is excreted in urine. And what does that do to this initial stimulus? It subtracts. Right, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. The other thing happens, right? Overhydration. The hypothalamus can monitor that, tells the posterior pituitary to stop secreting antidiuretic hormone because the body has plenty of water. right? So there's a decrease in water resorption, more urine is produced, right? And again, that feeds back negatively to what the initial stimulus was due to ADH. All right, so let me find that nice exam figure someplace. Here it is. Okay, so this is in your study guide. Let's take a look at this particular figure. And let's look at some vertical columns first. All right, so I see a vertical column over here that's kind of colored maybe yellow or beige or something. What kind of color does that look like to you? Beige. Okay, so this beige color right here represents filtrate. Where do we find filtrate? In a tubular element, right? And if stuff stays in the filtrate, where does it end up? In urine and excreted from your body. So all of this stuff is going to be lost from your body if it stays there. Then here is the wall of the collecting duct. Here is some interstitial space between the collecting duct and a blood vessel. And let's take a look and see what's happening. So we want to see something about vasopressin. What's another name for vasopressin? I've asked you to remember this probably a number of times, but it's really hard to remember. What's another name for vasopressin? Antidiuretic hormone, right? Or ADH. All right, so, and where does this vasopressin come from? What gland? Posterior pituitary, under the control that we just looked at, under hypothalamic control. So when there's an increase in ADH, ADH is soluble in water. Right, so it can dissolve in plasma very easily. It can leak out through a capillary, and it can bind to a receptor. And since it is a polar compound, where does that receptor have to be? We've got to remember our physical chemistry for sure. Right? The receptor for a polar compound has to be extracellular because that polar compound can't get inside the cell. So the ADH receptor is on the cell membrane, and when ADH binds to that receptor, ATP is converted into cyclic AMP, and we know cyclic AMP to be also a second messenger. What's the first messenger in this particular case? It's going to be antidiuretic hormone, right? So the first messenger is always outside the cell, ADH in this case, that causes a buildup of a second messenger, cyclic AMP. And then cyclic AMP can activate a number of enzymatic reactions. It's a cascade. And it allows for these endosomes, right, to move from the cytoplasm to the apical surface of the cell. And remember, an endosome is a vesicle inside of a cell that's loaded, right, not on the inside, but the membrane is loaded with active kinds of proteins. They could be channels, for instance. They could be enzymes. And if they're inside the cell like this, they're inactive, but as soon as this vesicle moves over, fuses with the plasma membrane, now they are activated because this is where they're going to work. Right? And it just so happens that these things are pores for water. These are what we call aquaporins. So here we put some pores in the apical surface, and what was the initial stimulus for moving these aquaporins over here? Antidiuretic hormone, right? And so now we have these pores for water. Water can't get through the plasma membrane except for these pores, but now it has much more permeability because of all these aquaporins that have been placed. So water moves down its concentration gradient. The filtrate is about 300 milliosmolar. Inside the cell, 600 milliosmolar, more concentrated. So water is going to diffuse into this cell. Okay, and it will diffuse into this interstitial space. Right? And what about the osmolality of plasma? It's even saltier. So water then will diffuse into plasma. And if we look at it overall, water moves down its concentration gradient from filtrate back into the blood when these aquaporins are placed in the cell membrane, the apical surface of that plasma membrane. And what is the signal for that? What causes these aquaporins to be placed? ADH, antidiuretic hormone, and remember that's got to be a extracellular receptor, which means then that it has to work through a second messenger system. The second messenger in this particular case is cyclic AMP. All right, so this is a really nice exam figure because just about almost everything we learned in this class is contained on this slide. A lot of good physical chemistry. All right, I'll put that away for now. So how is plasma cleared? Well, it's cleared in the kidney, and there are three processes, and these three processes add up to produce renal plasma clearance. So here are the three processes. All right, so filtration is one, blood to filtrate. But some things are resorbed, so we have to subtract that from plasma clearance. And then also some things are secreted. We want to add that component to clearance. So add these things together with their proper direction. So the excretion rate is equal what? To the filtration rate plus secretion. These are both going from blood to filtrate minus resorption. And this is moving from filtrate back to blood. All right, so that's how we could calculate the excretion rate or renal clearance. Now, we talked about this already. Not all the blood delivered to the glomerulus is filtered into the glomerular capsule. 20% of all the blood that goes in there is filtered. The remainder passes into the efferent arteriole. But that's, even if there are harmful compounds in that remainder of fluid, those things can still be put into filtrate by tubular secretion, and that is an active transport process, like for urea, for instance. Glucose and amino acids, on the other hand, right, we don't want them in the filtrate. They are resorbed, and they're resorbed mostly in the proximal convoluted tubule. So glucose is filtered and put in the filtrate. Some amino acids are, but normally 100% of these materials are resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule by what we call carrier-mediated co-transport with sodium. We looked at that with glucose. So there are proteins in the membrane, right, like that co-transporter for sodium and glucose. And when that transporter is busy with a glucose and sodium, then it cannot transport another glucose and sodium that's on the outside of the cell. And if all the transporters are busy transporting glucose and sodium, we call that saturation. And if there's so much glucose in the filtrate, it produces saturation of the transporters, then not all of the glucose is going to be resorbed. Right? And it's going to stay in the filtrate and it's going to be lost as urine. And that condition, right, we call diabetes mellitus. Right? And that's when the level of glucose in the blood is way too high. That happens at about 180 to 200 decigrams per ml. Glucose and amino acid transporters usually don't saturate, but under conditions of hyperglycemia, okay, when blood glucose is so high, then that saturates the transporters and glucose is lost in the blood. Electrolyte balance. Okay, so we looked at water. Kidneys also regulate electrolyte concentration by matching excretion with ingestion. Control of plasma sodium is important in regulating blood volume. And if you regulate blood volume, what's another variable that goes along with it? Blood pressure, right? Just because of the Frank Starling law of the heart, increasing venous return. The control of plasma potassium is important. And for just the function of muscles, pretty much all of the potassium that's resorbed occurs in the proximal convoluted tubule. Okay, so most of it, 90% resorbed by the before the distal tube, right? Then 10% is resorbed variably in the distal convoluted tubule based on demands of the body, and that is regulated by a hormone, aldosterone. Aldosterone controls potassium secretion and sodium resorption. And you might get a question on a board exam about aldosterone, And what can, if you look at the what it does right here, maybe we should describe what it does. It works on both potassium and sodium, but what does it do for potassium compared to sodium? Is it the same thing or is it different? It's different. It causes potassium secretion, which means that you're going to lose potassium from your body, but it increases sodium resorption. So if you ever get a question about aldosterone on a test, right, and it says, well, aldosterone increases secretion of potassium and increases secretion of sodium, would that be a correct answer? No. What about increasing secretion of or decreasing secretion of potassium and decreasing secretion of sodium? No, because they're both going in the same direction, right? So if you ever see an answer where they're going in opposite directions, that's got to be the correct answer, right? They go in opposite directions, and you're going to see why in just a second. In the absence of aldosterone, 80% of remaining sodium is resorbed in the distal tubule and cortical collecting duct. When aldosterone is high, then all of it is resorbed from the filtrate. So in the absence, right, some is resorbed, but when there's aldosterone, all of it is resorbed and put back into the body. Okay, and then let's go here. Here. All right, so here is the hormone ADH that we were talking about. Now we want to look at aldosterone. And that's a hormone. What kind of hormone is aldosterone? Is it polar or nonpolar? Do you know this? Is it polar or nonpolar? Aldosterone is a steroid from the adrenal cortex. So if it's a steroid, what do you know? It is nonpolar, right? Lipids are nonpolar. And what can you tell me about nonpolar compounds in terms of diffusing across the cell membrane? They can go through, no problem. All right, so there's aldosterone in the blood from the adrenal cortex, moves through the interstitial space, so the columns of organization are still the same. In this particular case, aldosterone does enter the cell, and it binds to a cellular or cytoplasmic receptor. And when it binds to that cytoplasmic receptor, it translocates into the nucleus and it becomes a transcription factor. All right, so the hormone receptor complex is a transcription activator, a transcription factor. And so then what happens? Then protein synthesis begins. And what do you know about protein synthesis? How many steps is it? There is transcription inside the nucleus, translation, right, in the cytoplasm, the first step, transcription, as a result of this transcription factor being available, makes messenger RNA, right? That's the product of transcription. Messenger RNA then leaves the cell, and that is the blueprint on how to make a protein. And when amino acids are put together on a ribosome using the information in messenger RNA, what do we call that? That's the second step of protein synthesis, that is translation. All right, so we have messenger RNA increasing translation and protein synthesis, and a number of different kinds of proteins are produced when aldosterone enters the cell. Okay, it can make new channels for sodium and potassium. It can make new pumps for sodium and potassium because these channels and pumps are proteins, right? And it can even change the activity of pumps that, and channels that are inside the cell by making some regulatory molecules. All right, so let's look and see what some of these things are. All right, so here we have new pumps that are being made. The pump that we're most interested in is the sodium and potassium ATP pump. And what can you tell me about the motion of sodium and potassium from the sodium-potassium ATP pump? Opposite directions, same directions, or what? Opposite directions, that's right. This pump is in the basal lateral membrane, and which way does the sodium-potassium pump sodium? Outside the cell or to inside the cell? Outside, because you know sodium to be high outside the cell, so I think you would be able to remember that. All right, so here we have that sodium-potassium ATP pump. It's pumping sodium outside the cell and potassium in. All right, so now we have high potassium inside the cell, like what we're familiar with, and we have low potassium in the filtrate, so sodium is going to diffuse from high concentration to low concentration. So what happened to that potassium? Went from plasma into the cell and then into the filtrate. So what do we call that process of going from blood to filtrate? That is secretion, tubular secretion. And is that an active or passive process? Okay. In this particular case, because it needs the sodium potassium pump right here, it is an active process. Okay, it's only this last step right here that is passive. All right, and so here we have sodium that is in the filtrate, but inside the cell it's at low concentration because it's being pumped out all the time, right, by the sodium potassium ATP pump. So if it's held in a low concentration inside the cell, sodium is going to be resorbed through this sodium channel from the filtrate. And as a result of the sodium potassium pump being activated, now we have high sodium in the interstitial fluid, relatively low in the blood, and then sodium is going to be just resorbed back into the blood as a result of that. All right, so what happens with aldosterone? What happens to sodium and potassium? Potassium is resorbed or secreted? Potassium. All right, so here's inside the body, here's filtrate. What do you call going from blood to filtrate? Blood to filtrate. That is, could be filtration, but we're not in the glomerulus. That is what we call secretion, tubular secretion. All right, so potassium is secreted. And what about sodium? Does it go the same way? Can't go the same way because of the sodium potassium ATP pump. Right, it's going the opposite way, and it's going from filtrate to blood. What do we call filtrate to blood process? Filtrate to blood. Resorption. That's right. And so what you see right there is why potassium is secreted and sodium is resorbed. And the basic reason why is because the sodium potassium ATP pump makes that happen. Let's see if that works. I think that works. Okay. So, on that board exam, when you get a question about aldosterone, I think it should be pretty easy for you to answer that, because we know sodium and potassium are going to go in opposite directions, and that's due to the sodium potassium pump, which you learned about months ago, and the direction is potassium secretion, right, and sodium resorption. And that happens when sodium is at a low concentration inside your body. All right, let's see what some of our next slides look like. Juxtaglomerular apparatus. So what time do we go to? You guys are 12:45. Okay. All right, juxtaglomerular apparatus. This is a nice slide. This is what I wanted to show you. Pointer options. Thank you. Okay, so here we see Bowman's capsule, glomerulus on the inside. We've got the afferent arteriole going in, efferent coming out, proximal convoluted tubule, nice loop of Henle. And what tube is this where I have the cursor right now? That's the distal convoluted tubule, and this diagram is really nice and accurate because this distal tubule always passes right between the afferent and efferent arteriole. And this is the juxtaglomerular apparatus. That just means next to the glomerulus. And this thing is important in regulating blood pressure. All right, so here we see the distal convoluted tubule, and there are some special cells, right, that are bumping up against the arterioles. We're going to call this the macula densa cells. And there are also some cells which kind of wrap around the afferent arteriole. They're almost like a precapillary sphincter. We're going to call these granular cells, and that's really nice on this figure. I never noticed it before, but what do you see inside these cells? And that's probably, underneath a microscope, they have these granules, and hence that's why they're named. There are other kinds of cells in this apparatus, not named on this slide. I don't think anybody knows what their function is. They might have a function, so I won't mention them. Okay? And that juxtaglomerular apparatus is important for initiating this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. And you're familiar with that from the last test, right? renin is released from the granular cells within the afferent arteriole. And renin then converts angiotensinogen. What can you tell me about angiotensinogen? It is inactive, right? With renin, which is an enzyme, converts it to angiotensin 1, has some weak activity, but angiotensin 1 can be converted into angiotensin 2 by ACE in the lungs, right? And angiotensin 2 has a powerful effect by stimulating the release of aldosterone. So that's how that angiotensin, renin angiotensin aldosterone mechanism takes place. Inadequate intake of sodium always causes a decrease in blood volume, right? If we don't have proper sodium, decreases blood volume. And that's because the lower osmolality in the hypothalamus inhibits ADH secretion and causing less water resorption, right? So if we inhibit ADH, then we have a diuretic effect and then we lose more water. And that low blood volume and renal blood flow stimulate renin release from the granular cells. And this is due to the direct effects of blood pressure on the granular cells, right? Because lower osmolality causing less water resorption, blood pressure is decreasing, and also by sympathetic activity from the baroreceptor reflex. I mentioned that one already today. Okay, so here is a nice flow diagram, and this might be an exam figure. Does anybody know if this is an exam figure? Yeah, I think it is. All right, so let's look at this. So the stimulus is going to be low sodium intake. So sodium is decreasing in your body. We got low plasma sodium concentration. So low osmolality, not so much salt in the blood. That's monitored by the hypothalamus because there's osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. And that signals the posterior pituitary to stop releasing antidiuretic hormone. So antidiuretic hormone decreases. And with decreasing antidiuretic hormone, what about water resorption? It decreases, right? So it's going to decreasing ADH is like having a diuretic effect. And a diuretic effect is going to keep water in the filtrate. It's going to prevent resorption of water in the collecting ducts, right? And what were the name of the pores that we were looking at that were stimulated by antidiuretic hormone? There were the aquaporins on that one illustration, right? So if there's decreased resorption, there's less aquaporins in the membranes, and we hold on to water into the filtrate. That increases urine volume, and when urine volume increases, that decreases blood volume. And that's going to increase sympathetic nerve activity because blood pressure is going to decrease. The vasomotor center is going to increase sympathetic activity. And that also goes to the juxtaglomerular apparatus. And that increases renin, angiotensin 2. Don't forget a couple steps in there. 2 goes to the adrenal cortex and stimulates aldosterone. And we just looked at aldosterone diagram before. And what's the effect of aldosterone on sodium and potassium? It increases sodium resorption and potassium secretion. All right, so if we increase resorption of sodium, we increase sodium in the blood. And what was the initial stimulus? Low sodium, right? So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so in this particular case, here's an easy way to remember that increasing aldosterone increases sodium in the body by increasing resorption. Increasing aldosterone causes increased resorption of sodium, and then you don't have to worry about potassium because it just goes the opposite way. All right, so look at those slides that are not from your book. We've talked about pretty much all those slides already. Atrial natriuretic peptide, you know that it comes from the atria when the walls of the atria are stretched. When are the walls of the atria stretched? What's happening to the atria? Why are they stretching? Okay, yeah, there's stretch receptors in the walls, right? And that's because blood volume increases, venous return increases, And so that's stretching the walls of the atria, and that stimulates the secretion of atrial natriuretic hormone. It's antagonistic to aldosterone. It stimulates salt and water excretion, right? It's antagonist. It's also antagonistic to ADH. Right, and it acts as an endogenous diuretic. So atrial natriuretic peptide is antagonistic to both aldosterone and antidiuretic hormone. Right, so aldosterone would be this third line over here, and ADH would be relating to this fourth line, independent of each other. Okay, so that is urinary system. Do you want to go over any of those figures once again? These nifty ones right here? These aren't in your book. I think your book talks about it, but they don't have a very good figure. Here are the very good figures for that. All right, but I don't think you have to brush up on protein synthesis. I don't know, maybe you do. Two-step process, transcription, translation. Okay. Transcription produces messenger RNA, translation requires messenger RNA, and what does transcription and translation produce? It produces new proteins, right? That's just the steps in protein synthesis. And those proteins can be channels, they can be pumps, they can be other regulatory molecules that regulate channels and even pumps. Okay. And that is due to aldosterone, which is a nonpolar compound. Nonpolar compounds have cytoplasmic receptors, and these cytoplasmic receptors act as transcription factors, can initiate transcription, right, which produces these new proteins. Okay, what about the other figure? Anybody have a question about the other figure? Okay, all right, well, I like both of those diagrams a lot. Otherwise, I wouldn't have given you a copy. And so here is the key, and then here is the blanked out diagram, because you don't have the key in your book. So I think you would like to know all of these different question marks right here. So it's a really good flow diagram. And the same thing for antidiuretic hormone. And what's another name for antidiuretic hormone? Yeah, vasopressin. Okay. So that's it for today, I think. No, I want to talk to you about reproduction. We got a couple minutes, okay? And that's going to be our next topic. And so I'll turn the lights on. What's the purpose of the reproductive system? Purpose of the reproductive system. Okay, it seems like it's really obvious, but I don't think it is. Purpose? You guys are just really shy or something, or what? It's to what? Okay. A lot of times people think it's just to make new people, right? But there's something special going on. All right, so you know yourself pretty well, so why don't you look around the room, and do you see another you anywhere in the room? Go ahead, look around. You see another you someplace? There's no twins in here? There's no twins in here. Okay. I have twins in some of my other classes, so it doesn't work so well for them, but it still does in a way. All right, so you don't see another you here. Now go to a place where there's 100,000 people, like maybe the Coliseum for a football game. And you look around all 100,000 people, do you see another you there? And you look at all those people. Have you ever tried that? Have you ever found another you someplace? Is it possible to find another you? Okay, well, the answer is no. There's no other, even if you look all over the whole world, you'd never find another you, exactly, right? Okay, so the purpose of the reproductive system is to produce something new and unique, not just the same thing over and over and over again, right? So you are new and unique. You're a partial combination of your parents, which is new and unique. And then here is something kind of interesting, and that is your parents had you at one point in time. Could they make another you, say, 10 years later? Another exact copy, just like you, like an identical twin, except 10 years later. And everybody is shaking their head no. But you know what? If your parents made you, they can make another you, right, at some later time. It all depends on chance. And the chances of that happening are so astronomically high that it has probably never, ever happened and never will happen. just the way that that mechanism of making gametes takes place. Okay, so we're going to look and see why the reproductive system is so complicated. Let me show you something right here. I'll do a quick search. All right, so here's an animal, and it has a body tube that acts as a digestive system, right? And then here's the mouth that has some tentacles. When a little food particle starts to swim by, these tentacles brush up against it. There's stinging cells on these tentacles that poison that this little organism that's swimming around, and the tentacle brings it over to the mouth, and it's digested. So this is typically what we call a polyp, and specifically this is a hydra. And notice that on this particular hydra, on this body tube right here, there is a bud. And this bud is going to grow and grow and grow, and it's going to look exactly like this parent, and when it gets big enough, it's going to drop off and be another hydra someplace, right? It's just going to be in the environment. So do we reproduce that way? No, we don't walk around and then all of a sudden feel a little bulge on our side, right? And then 9 months later, a little baby falls off. That does not happen, right? So, and the second hydra that is produced is exactly the same as the first one, right? So reproduction has taken place, but what kind of reproduction is that? Is that sexual or asexual reproduction? That is what we call asexual reproduction. So asexual reproduction produces the same organism over and over and over again. All the organisms in this population are going to be the same. And when that happens, if one organism is susceptible to a particular infection, what can you tell me about the whole population? The whole population is susceptible to that disease process. So that's not a very strong population. All right, well, we just said that when we look at ourselves, we're new and unique because we don't come about by asexual reproduction. We come about by sexual reproduction, which produces something new and unique, so that when there is a disease process, like if there's a flu bug going around, will everybody come down? Will everybody be sensitive to that infection? And the answer is no, because we're all different. And so sexual reproduction provides for diversity in a population, and that explains why we have all these weird things, right? Like some people have a penis. Some have vagina, some have uterus, some have ovaries, some have testes, right? It's really complicated, and all those complicated mechanisms are important because it produces, what does it produce in our population? It produces strength through diversity, right? Okay. So we're going to look at the control of the reproductive system next time. But I want you to know what's the function of the reproductive system? Yeah, producing something new and unique. New and unique, not just the same thing over and over and over again. Okay, so bring the slides for a reproductive system and questions for a urinary system if you have them. And sign-in sheet is going around someplace. And make sure you know that nephron structure and the three functions that produce urine.